Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to Rosie on the House, your weekend happy place, where we're talking American history this morning, celebrating the Declaration of Independence signing, which Dr. David Dean informs me wasn't even signed on July 4th.
Yeah, it was several days there. They had to do a couple of pen edits and things along the way. And then, of course, it gets distributed and read out on the broadsides. But the signature that they send off to the copy to the king and everything was signed over several days to get everybody together.
Hey, how would you have liked to have been in the room when the king opened that and read it?
That would have been very interesting. Of course, we know that King George III was a little off his rocker at times, so he might not have even known what the color of the sky was that day, so let alone. But I heard that he was very upset that the colonies were. He took it personally, was very upset that the colonies were rebelling.
I wonder what happened to the messenger that delivered it. Do we know?
History probably has lost that story.
Okay, So we were talking a little bit about the freedom of religion and how these basically religious men, all believing in the Bible, although all different denominations, could elect to just opt out of basically what the Bible says. To be a good citizen, you should pay unto Caesar what's Caesar's.
Well,
and then we get these different denominations, top-down management, kind of elder-driven, and then we have the bottom-up congregation-driven, and they're kind of at war with each other. And then Martin Luther comes out, and why were they so concerned about freedom from religion in government? I mean, it was completely interwoven in the politics at that point.
Well, it was, but again, go back to your superstitious world. The superstitious world, everybody was Catholic. And so part of the breakdown of that that spurs the Enlightenment on is, of course, the Reformation that happens in Germany, where Luther challenges not only the absolute authority of the church, but he challenges the absolute authority of the monarchies who embrace the church. And so now, 150 years later here in America, we're still making those challenges to those absolute authorities. And if the Anglican Church is telling everybody you got to do things this way, and they're persecuting the Episcopalian or the Presbyterians or the Baptists, and the Baptists are saying, "Well, wait a minute, we believe that again, our reason, our faith, our conviction is what we should be following because that's again an Enlightenment kind of principle," then that creates that kind of conflict. And so, what our Enlightenment founding fathers basically came to was that. We need to exercise, let men's own conscience. That's the Enlightenment kind of ideal. Let men's own conscience. The state shouldn't tell you what you should believe or what church you should go to. You should be able to exercise your own conscience, your own faith, your own belief system, and let that go. Now, they're not talking about, well, go off and practice strange things. They're talking about letting everybody come to those same different avenues to the same belief in God, the Creator, that is part of their Enlightenment kind of ideals. So, like, for example, Jefferson and Adams go on a big debate about this. Jefferson wanted the disestablishment of all these things. He wanted the state to refrain from meddling in religious institutions and disciplines and doctrines and all those different kind of things. Again, one of our most inalienable sacred rights, according to Jefferson, is that free exercise of religion, where John Adams says, well, not only should we be able to do that, but liberty requires that the state balance some things. Maybe we should have a public religion. We should have something that puts everybody kind of commonly together, a set of values, set of beliefs that we would have as a nation, as a people. We could define that by the same creed of honesty, diligence, and obedience, and virtues and things. We could have icons like the Bells of Liberty and memorials to patriots and the Constitution. Our clergy would be our public servants, would be ministers and people who were devout politicians. And the liturgy would be those proclamations, those prayers, those oaths, songs, Thanksgiving Day sermons, anything that kind of promoted people back into that kind of civic religion. So Adams, even though he believed that for you to have your own belief system, we should give everybody a common one also, whereas Jefferson was completely opposite. So everybody should have freedom to do kind of what they believe on their own.
And Adams was kind of on the side of the majority of the founding fathers. The majority of the founding fathers were kind of Federalists.
Federalists. Mm-hmm.
Thomas Jefferson stands as one of the very few anti-Federalists. Who were Jefferson's mentors? Where did he develop his concepts?
Well, Jefferson was a student of the Enlightenment, a student of philosophy on his own. He was a largely self-educated. He was a voracious reader. He had a huge library. In fact, he actually, when he was reading through the Bible, the New Testament, he was reconciling those things with those Enlightenment ideals, and he would find that sometimes things didn't line up, like the render under Caesar kind of prompt things. And so he would take a penknife, one of those little sharp blades that you would use to sharpen your quill pens, and he would cut passages out of the scriptures and paste them into his own book, where he kind of created his own kind of the teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, and that was kind of his Bible. It was a one that he felt that had not been mucked up, so to speak, by human interference, because this made more sense to his Enlightenment sensibilities.
It's peculiar that him standing alone as one of the few anti-Federalists, that the Group of Five appoint him as the leader, let him go sequester himself, write the document, and turn it in for editing.
He was considered one of the better writers of the convention, and so a lot of them kind of didn't want to, it's a big task to kind of dream this stuff up. So let's give it to the new guy, and let him kind of come up with the first draft, and then we'll play around with it, kind of a thing.
There's some incredible concepts in the Declaration of Independence, to say the least. Well, I've read Thomas Jefferson's biography, but I think I may have to go back and reread it again. Was he a wimp?
Seems
like every time something important came up, he had to retreat to Monticello with a headache.
Well, he did have bears in the White House when he was president. Had bears on the lawn of the White House. So I'm not sure he was necessarily a wimp.
Okay.
But I think he shied away from political conflict. Because, again, that would have been part of his Enlightenment sensibilities, would have been to let reason, let conversation, let discourse kind of occur without it being contentious. And I think he was a man that didn't like contentious. On his inauguration day, so transfer of power, he gets up and has breakfast and walks to his own down Pennsylvania Avenue to his own inauguration, kind of a not a lot of fanfare kind of thing. So I think that was just part of his sensibilities.
Well, I sure like his concepts of independence, self-regulation, kind of states' rights, but I've always had the impression he was a wimp. I don't know how else to put it.
Well, to flip that would be, again, Washington, he's not one seeking power. He's seeking to return power to the people. He believes strongly in the yeoman farmer, that the educated American can make good political decisions. He believed in the power of democracy in its purest form, and that let the citizens decide. They are the holders of the power. Very John Locke kind of thing. The purpose of government is to protect those life, liberty, and happiness type things. When government fails to do so, it's the obligation of the people to get rid of that government and start anew. And so he really believed.
What did you just say?
He really believed that people should do that. Oh, I'm subversive as I'm being with John Locke there, yes. That notion that, our government's purpose is to take care of those life, liberty, and happiness type things. Happiness being the pursuit of happiness, your livelihood, what makes you money, what makes you feel good. If you want to go off and squander it all, that's perfectly okay. If you want to invest it and pass that on to your family, whatever that is that makes you happy, you have those rights.
Who is Locke?
John Locke was one of our Enlightenment philosophers. He's in England. He is writing about the Glorious Revolution, the kind of the transfer of power in England, because he's writing against kind of a Cromwell, a person who stands up and says, well, let's get rid of the king, but I'll be in charge now. I'm the power and authority. And again, he's like, no, no, no. Power comes from the people. We lend our power to the government, and then the government then uses that power to protect us, to work on our behalf for our greater good. And so those ideas are carried over into Jefferson. Jefferson was a big student of Locke and carries those things over. In fact,
are they contemporaries? Locke's alive?
They're not quite contemporaries.
Okay.
But Jefferson changes the wording. Locke writes about life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Jefferson changes that to happiness. But the two mean the same sort of thing. Property is just the evidence of what wealth you've accumulated, your hard work, whatever you do with your hands or your intellect. That should your compensation for that, what you get paid for doing that, should be yours to keep and do, not to pay taxes to the government or give to the king or something else. And so Jefferson just translates that to happiness because not everybody owns property. But they do work hard and should have the benefit of that labor.
We're here with Dr. David Dean, Assistant Professor of History from Grand Canyon University, talking about religion, talking about politics, the two things we're always told never talk about in public. And we're having fun doing it. I appreciate you coming in. We're going to be talking about, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back and wrap it all up. Who wrote Common Sense?
Thomas Paine.
That was Thomas Paine. I want to talk a little bit about maybe what that document did to influence kind of how many signers of the Declaration?
56.
56. Why did John Hancock, was he arrogant?
No, I think he just didn't realize that 55 other people were going to sign the same piece of paper.
He had all this room at the bottom to sign his name.
Although Schoolhouse Rock would suggest that he did it so that the king wouldn't have to wear his glasses to see his signature.
Oh, interesting. So he was a bold fellow.
Yeah, bold fellow. And again, when the British put a price on his head for being a revolutionary and also being a kind of a smuggler, not paying taxes and things, of £500, he was kind of incensed that it wasn't higher. So.
I love it. Very good. Well, we'll be back with more with Dr. David Dean in just a minute. Y'all hang on.